Hello all, Joshua Gilliland here, attorney blogger on the Legal Geeks. The following audio was recorded live at San Francisco Comic-Con. This is from our Defending the Defenders panel with Angela Story. Hope you enjoy.
Good evening. How's everyone doing?
Good.
My name's Joshua Gilliland.
I'm Angela Story.
And we run the blog The Legal Geeks. And thank you all for attending our Defending the Defenders. We know with the time change that might have confused a few people, so thank you all, since it is the dinner hour. And this one isn't a Gallagher show, so it's okay if you want to move forward. We're not going to ask you questions. We'll leave time at the end so you can ask us questions, but it's okay to come forward if you want, because it's a nice big room. So, who here's binged The Defender so far? Who's seen both seasons of Daredevil? Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, and Iron Fist. Yeah, it had potential, and they made up for it in Defenders. So let's talk about legal issues from all of these. We're going to touch on all of these shows, some a little bit more so than others, and some of the legal issues that were in Defenders, because with these shows, different ones do a stronger and some a weaker job when it comes to the practice of law. And we'll get into that with the analysis. But with Defenders, they were pretty much in the ballpark the entire time. Wasn't perfect, but it was at least in the ballpark. And as an attorney, I never yelled at the screen. I did in Daredevil Season 2.
Yes.
Yeah. And let's break that down. So let's talk about in The Defenders when we have the first meeting between Matt Murdock and Jessica Jones and the immediate issue of client solicitation that comes up when someone's in legal jeopardy.
So Matt and Foggy, the way they seem to get all of their clients is they find out they're in jail or the hospital and they walk into the cell or the hospital and say, "Where are your lawyers?" You can't do that. It's not allowed. A lawyer is not allowed to solicit a client. You can't do it in person or by telephone, computer. You cannot solicit a client. You can't just walk up to somebody, say, "Hey, I heard you got arrested. Do you want me to defend you?" That is not allowed by the ethics laws in every state, and that seems to be how they get every single client from Jessica Jones to Frank Castle. That one was particularly concerning, seeing as how he already had a lawyer. And then they walk in and say, "Fire him, hire us, you don't know us." And same with Karen Page, just walking in saying, "Stop talking, I'm your lawyer." It doesn't happen. It is one of those where we yell at the screen.
On the flip side, what Matt did in telling her to stop talking was right.
Yes.
The only character in a police interrogation in any of these shows that was actually smart, that did the right thing, was Shades. And so when he's eventually arrested in Luke Cage, and he keeps saying, "Lawyer," that would end all questioning. That would mean they would have to stand up, walk out of the room, because anything that he said after that would be inadmissible. And so the fact that Matt comes in and says, "Shut up," was the right thing to do, even though it's an in-person client solicitation, and that is a no-no. Which then brings us to the issue of what's said to Matt between Jessica Jones and he, and the issue of attorney confidentiality.
Right, so there is some issue as to, she says, "I'll find my own lawyer," so is he her lawyer? However, an attorney has an ethical duty to not disclose any information related to the representation of a client. And that's whether they get the information from the client or from somebody else. So at that point, since there seemed to be at least a preliminary attorney-client discussion, she hadn't retained him as an attorney, but it was at least a discussion about possibly retaining, that it would be covered under the attorney-client or the confidentiality, and also would be an attorney-client privilege. Now, he's not great at holding confidences or attorney-client privilege, which is another issue, but
anything that she had said to him, had she disclosed some information about the Kilgrave, would have been under attorney-client confidentiality.
Yeah, and normally when you have something that's attorney-client privilege, it has to be about a legal opinion and asking for legal help, and that's not quite happening in that interview. Which brings us to the issue of duty of competency. And lawyers have to be competent to practice law, and normally means we have different areas of specialty. For example, I focus on electronically stored information, also known as e-discovery. Angela does?
I do civil litigation.
So when we are introduced to Jerry Hogarth and see her in all the different series, Jerry is a character. She wouldn't exist in nature. No lawyers like that, because when you look at her practice areas, it's criminal defense, it's personal injury, it's probate, as we saw in Iron Fist, and patent law, which we also saw in Jessica Jones. That doesn't happen. You would see an attorney who could do criminal defense and maybe personal injury. That's normally a solo practitioner, small firm. You could also see somebody doing personal injury and probate. That's highly likely. But you wouldn't see any of those combinations with somebody doing patent law. And so when you look at her really complex practice areas, that wouldn't exist in nature. And it would also be really high risk for malpractice insurance.
It existed 20, 30 years ago when attorneys did a little bit of everything. It still exists if you're a small town attorney and you're the only attorney for, 50 miles. But even then, you wouldn't be doing patent law. I would question the competency of any attorney who's doing all of these things because those areas are now becoming so specialized.
It would mean she would have a higher level degree in something like electrical engineering or chemistry if she was also doing patent law. Yeah. So it's a very, they throw a lot at her. Now let's talk about the issue of community service and whether or not vigilantism is just really creative pro bono community service. And Angela, your thoughts on this?
So almost every state's bar association encourages or requires their attorneys to do some sort of community service or pro bono work. The question is, does being daredevil cover that requirement? No. particularly in New York. In many states, if you are convicted of a crime, you run the risk of being disbarred. However, in New York, if you are convicted of a felony, you are automatically disbarred. Now, is what he's doing a felony? Yes. He's not just beating people up. He's beating people up and inflicting great bodily harm. Which would classify the assault as a felony, which is intentionally causing serious physical injury to another person or using deadly weapon or a dangerous instrument. The fact that you are doing it for the greater good doesn't mitigate the fact it is still a felony, and should he be convicted unmasked and convicted, he would automatically be disbarred for this, if not a host of other issues.
Just because he won't kill anyone, he still does a lot of spinal injuries. And any hallway fight, you see that, there are spinal injuries. So, like, what's worse? And because people are going to be paraplegic after dealing with him. But there is something that actually could be really creative community service, or at least not something he would be prosecuted for, and that's defense of others. So Daredevil's community service is different than many other vigilantes. Because he's not just going out beating up bad guys, but he's going out saving people. In the first episode, he saves women who are being loaded into a shipping container from being sold into white slavery. Good. We want to encourage people to stop that kind of behavior. And if you're out saving people, there it's something that can be called defense of others. It's a form of self-defense. So if somebody's being harmed, like being loaded into a shipping container to be sold overseas, and he goes out and stops that, he's defending those victims from being sold into slavery, and that's justified. So if all of his law vigilantism was just limited to that, it'd be a lot harder to convict him, because what he's doing is helping those who are being kidnapped. So it's a very interesting character dynamic there. Yeah. Which brings us to Jessica Jones and Serve as a Process.
The selfie. I loved this one. She goes to serve a summons on the strip club owner.
Yep. Gregory Spiros.
Sees him in his car, knocks, he's not answering, she gets it to him, takes a picture of him. I saw this and I actually sent an email to my process server saying, can you start taking pictures when you serve people? It's a brilliant idea. In order to serve a complaint on somebody in every state, you have to either personally serve them. There are some ways to do it via certified mail, but really personal service is the best. But what does that do? It gets you in, oftentimes gets you into a he said, she said, I didn't get served. Process server says, yes, they did. I've had a number of hearings where my process server says, yes, I served them. Defendant says, no, I never got served. The selfie is beautiful. You've got metadata on there to show, you know, the location, the time. There's no dispute that it's the defendant if they were to come in and you know, argue that they hadn't been served at something that, frankly, I think that process server should start doing.
I have a friend who's a judge in New York City, and when he saw this, he was giddy. Because he's like, this is awesome! Because that could be attached to the affidavit that the process server files with all of that geo metadata that shows when and where that person was served. So this episode was like, awesome!
It was. Yeah. I loved it.
Which brings us to Father Lantum. You know, Daredevil being the good, tortured Catholic that he is, who seems to go in to confess every 3 days, would the good priest be forced to testify about any of that information that was disclosed during confession? And the answer under New York is no, under no circumstances, because everything that Matt Murdock said to his priest was seeking spiritual consulting about what he was doing and how he was feeling, and he was seeking guidance that was clearly protected under the clergy privilege. It's one of those neat little privileges that they could not be forced to disclose that information.
And the clergy privilege is right up there with the attorney-client privilege in that it is something that the courts take very seriously and do not violate. Some of the others they have wiggle room on, but the clergy privilege is something that they are loath to violate.
Which brings us to Hope and the Insanity Defense.
All right. So Hope is under the power of Kilgrave. Looks like she's okay. She's happy to see her parents.
And then she kills them.
Yeah. With seemingly no remorse and no thought, she pulls out a gun, shoots them dead, turns around and says, smile. But one of the interesting things she says before that to Jessica is that Kilgrave made her do things, quote, I didn't want to do, but I wanted to. And that she tried to resist. So what that tells us is she tried to stop herself from doing it. She knew what she was doing was wrong, but she couldn't stop herself. And that is really important when you look at the insanity defense. I love the insanity defense. It has morphed over time. But in New York, the standard for the insanity defense is that she lacked the capacity to know or appreciate either, one, the nature and consequences of her actions, or that her actions were wrong. But by that statement, I didn't want to, but I wanted to, she's saying she knew the consequences of her actions and that she knew her actions were wrong. So could she have a defense of insanity in New York? Very questionable. Used to be an insanity defense called the irresistible impulse test. And that's a very different test in that it basically says you may have known what was wrong. You knew it was wrong, but because of a defect or disease of the mind, you were unable to control your actions. So under the irresistible impulse test, she would have a defense of insanity. However, after Ronald Reagan's attempted assassination, Many of the states and the federal government went through, changed their insanity defenses. I believe only Virginia at this point has anything remotely close to the irresistible impulse test. All of the others require that you had to know, or you couldn't know that it was wrong, or you couldn't appreciate your consequences. So while a jury may take sympathy to her, she's probably doesn't have a really good defense of insanity in this one.
And here's the neat thing about the law. I disagree, because I actually do think she has a very strong insanity defense, but it's going to take some expert testimony to prove it. From what we learn of how Kilgrave's power worked is that he emits a virus through pheromones, and that those who are around him are immediately infected with that virus, which makes them susceptible to his power of suggestion. So in order to prove this, you're going to need expert testimony that will need to show that virus that he admits and show it infecting cells. And that being able to have that expert testimony and that scientific evidence, you could show to a judge and jury that this is the effect he had upon individuals. You would then need to also dig into what else happened to her. You know, Kilgrave told her to lie in a bed and stay there for X amount of hours. You know, she soiled herself laying there. It was disgusting. It was the sort of thing that human beings don't do. And showing the totality of the circumstances of what happened to her, a jury would look at this and go like, there was something clearly going on here with anyone who had been Kilgraved, which turns into a very long list.
Except that cases where the defendants have claimed brainwashing or mind control have been relatively unsuccessful.
Yeah, and so the last time that happened was actually locally, because you have Sirhan, who killed Senator Robert Kennedy in 1968, made an argument in a writ of habeas corpus in the last like 5 years, and it was before Judge Breyer, whose older brother is on the U.S. Supreme Court, and saying, I was under some form of mind control when I killed Senator Kennedy. And that argument didn't fly. Part of it was, it's like, well, you did that in 1968. It's now 2014. No.
A little late.
Real late. You killed a Kennedy. We're not letting you get away with that. And if it had been 1969, and Sirhan had talked about some guy in a bar that was making a post-hypnotic suggestion upon him, maybe it could have had a different result in 1969. But it didn't. And when that form of the insanity defense was made back in late 68, early 69, one of the chief prosecutor who prosecuted Sirhan had very strong feelings on the insanity defense. He actually said, throw it out. It's all mumble jumbo. And he attacked the experts, and the jury agreed with them and threw out all of that evidence.
And in fact, several states do not allow a defense of insanity anymore.
So yeah, and there are those who do. And so it's a very complicated history. We've blogged about it. One of the biggest cases was the assassination of President Garfield, and where that was made by a guy who was clearly off his rocker, but since he knew right from wrong, and he admitted that, and he admitted to hesitating before shooting President Garfield, the jury said, that's good enough for us, and he was hung within a week after the trial. We didn't mess around. Let's talk about Karen Page.
Speaking of hesitating before you continue to shoot, so Karen is kidnapped by Wesley, drugged, taken to a warehouse. She is disoriented, difficulty moving. He puts a gun in front of her, gives her an ultimatum, threatens to kill everyone she knows, everyone she loves, and then kill her if she doesn't comply.
His phone rings, she grabs the gun, and she shoots someone.
Once.
She then thinks about it and then empties the clip into him.
It's that
hesitation
that causes the problem in terms of whether or not what she did was in self-defense. Now, if that first bullet killed him, not an issue. But if it was the emptying the clip into him that killed him,
The question is there self-defense? Now, in New York, you can use deadly force in self-defense unless you have a way to get to complete safety. There is no stand your ground in New York unless you are in your own home, in which case, shoot away. So, could she get to safety? No. She couldn't even, she could hardly walk, she couldn't, you know, she was drugged. Wasn't a way to get to safety. But was she in immediate danger? And that's one of the other requirements in New York, is you have to have the threat of immediate deadly force upon you. Well, she was in immediate danger. I mean, you have somebody, she's already been set up for murder once. Somebody's tried to kill her before. And now she's listening to somebody say that they're going to kill everybody she loves. She empties the clip, or she shoots once, actually seems to check the gun, and then empties it into her. Would a DA prosecute this case? Probably not.
Not only that, that phone going off could have been the tip-off for everyone she knows dying, because everyone who crossed Wilson Fisk kept ending up dead. So I do think she was justified in emptying the clip into him.
I think any jury would probably give her an acquittal based on self-defense under the circumstances. And if she's smart, she probably wouldn't necessarily take the stand and mention that she hesitated between the first shot and emptying the clip.
And this is also interesting because she's the only one that gets away with the perfect crime in any of these series. Let's talk about killing Kilgrave. And one of the things that's disturbing about the Jessica Jones series in comparison to Daredevil Season 1, Daredevil spends all of Season 1 working up on, I will not kill Wilson Fisk, it is wrong to kill, it's a venial sin, I will not do that. Jessica Jones is working up to, I'm going to kill the guy who harmed me, because he's that dangerous. And at the end, he is. His powers have been enhanced. He has a riot going on with people harming each other. Snapping his neck, arguably, was the right thing to do. It's just super creepy because most superhero stories are not about killing the bad guy. They're about making sure the bad guy is arrested. And so this is one of those reasons why this series is a lot more sinister in how it ends, because you have a lot of dead bodies at the end of
There's
this.
There's more vengeance than justice in it.
And also other casualties. Let's talk about where we started screaming the most.
So we could probably do 2 hours on what was wrong with the trial of Frank Castle. Goodness gracious. So we'll start with the DA and the violations that the DA made. Getting someone to falsify medical examiner reports right there. Speaking with Frank Castle when she knows that he's represented by an attorney. That's a huge no-no. You can't speak to someone if you know that they're represented by an attorney. Threatening Matt and Foggy against representing. You can't do that. And then putting a witness on the stand and asking them questions, knowing that that witness is going to lie. That is a huge no-no. The only time you can put a witness on the stand knowing they're going to lie is if you are a criminal defense attorney and your client insists on taking the stand. And even then, the only question you can ask him, more or less, is, what do you want to say? Tell me what happened. You actually can't ask your client questions to elicit a story that you know is false. So you know he's lying. The district attorney knows he's lying. The judge knows he's lying. Jury probably knows he's lying. But you cannot assist in perjury. So that was the one that I'm screaming up and down for. Signs in the courtroom. Protests in the courtroom. Not allowed. No judge would allow that.
The defense attorney should have stood up and had all of those signs read into the record, because that would be grounds for an immediate mistrial. And if appealed, they would have reversed or remanded because that's highly prejudicial. You can't do that.
No. Having a trial a week from the arraignment?
No.
Well, the client wanted it. No, no. An attorney can go in and get a continuance on the grounds of unable to be prepared over the client's objections, and that's what Matt and Foggy should have done.
That, and the DA can't go like, no, I want to do this in a week.
No.
No. They have a right to a fair trial. You don't get to cram your timetable down their throat.
Nor does the DA get to choose whether or not you're in general pop or protective custody once you go to prison. They can make recommendations, but that's up to the Department of Corrections, and it's not an issue of punishment, it's an issue of safety for the inmates. So that was crazy.
Yeah, the DA is super evil, and the stuff that she does is way over the top and just wouldn't happen. But we do have a competency issue, multiple competency issues. So they have a week to prepare for trial, which shouldn't happen. And Matt spends a lot of time as Daredevil with Elektra going out, chasing down the hand, finding that giant, you know, 40-story hole in Manhattan, like all of those things that where he should have been prepping for trial. And there's the great issue of, like, did he violate his duty of loyalty because he didn't adequately prepare? And I would say yes.
Absolutely.
Because he didn't set the alarm, he overslept, there's all kinds of bad things happening because he doesn't prepare. And a lot of those issues with him running off Elektra weren't, hey, I need to do this right now. What he needed to do right now was prepare for trial. The other half of this is Foggy blows it big time. His rambling, horrific opening statement would not get him a job with Hogarth. Okay. That's a great way to get disbarred. And here's the thing, when you're the defense, you don't have to give your opening statement at the beginning of the case.
And the judge asked him, do you want to defer? And he said, no, Your Honor, we're ready. And
the answer should have been, yes. The way I like to think for criminal defense attorneys is deferring your opening statement and waiting till after the prosecution finishes their case in chief is that your opening statement is then the sorbet that cleanses the palate of the jury. Because you can then tell your story and basically you do a mini closing argument responding to everything the DA just did. And then you begin your case in chief. So he needed to say, yes, I will defer, and not stumble around the courtroom.
Well, and neither he nor the DA actually gave an opening statement. Those were closing arguments.
Yeah.
They were not opening statements.
An opening statement is the roadmap you give to the jury. You lay out your themes. You talk about the issues and who's going to present what evidence. You don't get up there and argue. That's a closing argument. So let's talk about the attorney-client privilege and Karen talking to Frank Castle.
Right. So Frank will only talk to Karen, despite the fact she is not a lawyer, she's not licensed to practice law. The question is what they talk about covered under the attorney-client privilege? And the answer is yes. So the attorney-client privilege extends to legal office staff, as long as it's facilitating communication to and from the attorney. So Karen's going to meet with Frank Castle. Foggy gives her questions. She's bringing the information back to him. Anything that they say would absolutely be covered under the attorney-client privilege. Now, was she giving legal advice? Because she is not allowed to give legal advice. And the answer is she was doing really well. She wasn't giving legal advice. She was talking to him, telling the story, discussing what the attorneys were, you know, thinking, right up until she came in and said, you need to take the stand. It's the only way. And right there, she violated the rule on you can't give legal advice. That's practicing law. Now, she had come in and said, I've spoken to Foggy. He wants me to ask you, are you willing to take the stand? That would have been okay. But at this point, she is giving her opinion, her legal advice, and that that would be unauthorized practice of law.
Yeah, a boo-boo.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the battle of the expert witnesses, because they're actually ballpark with this.
Yeah, they the defense expert I liked a lot. The questioning was good. His explanations were good. Whether or not he wasn't necessarily putting forth the insanity defense, but more a mitigation, trying to bring this down from premeditated murder to perhaps a murder of passion, because Frank Castle simply couldn't control, his brain was in a constant state of chaos, not trying to get him off necessarily, but bringing it down to a lesser degree. The medical examiner was interesting. You know, as soon as he starts saying, I have something I want to say, and the judge immediately says, clear the courtroom. No. It's a public trial. The public is allowed. A judge has to have a really good reason to clear a courtroom, and that wouldn't have been it. Now, whether or not she could have had the jury leave, that's a possibility, but unlikely, because he's still on the stand. He's still giving testimony. But interesting, she goes and strikes the medical examiner's testimony completely. Well, the problem there is now the DA, there is no evidence that the DA has presented about how these people died. There's no...
It's problematic because that's also trying to get into Frank's family being killed.
Right.
And they needed that. There's another issue that happens in the trial where we have the state's expert that's in rebuttal to the defense's expert witness. And Matt asks a leading question on cross-examination.
Objection, leading.
And the judge sustains it, and that's wrong.
Cross-examination, that's what you do. You ask leading questions.
So with a cross-examination, this is where you're trying to impeach somebody and you're trying to pound on them. And you ask questions of, you only examined one patient, didn't you? Yes.
The idea is you only want the witness to answer yes or no. So you ask a leading question. If you let them start talking, you're losing control.
And they completely blow that.
Yeah.
And it's very frustrating because there's so many trial issues wrong. And we'll talk about what they have right, but let's
focus. Matt's, when he said, oh, well, I'll just ask the medical examiner, who'd you get to change the report? Lack of foundation. You haven't actually established that the report had been changed yet, so they jump a few steps.
Yeah, they're a little bit on the map. The other highly dangerous thing that they did was adding the colonel to be a character witness for Frank Castle. Now, you can have somebody testify to your good character, but when you do that, you then open the door for bad character evidence. Now, the rule across the country is bad character evidence is not allowed unless good character evidence has been offered. So having the colonel testify about Frank being a hero in Afghanistan then opens the door for the district attorney to start putting up people who can then talk about Frank murdering rooms full of people.
I mean, it opened the door wide open to an area the defense did not want to go down.
Yeah, highly dangerous for them to have done that. Which brings us to the direct examination of the Punisher. And this was super painful to watch because normally you don't want the defendant, especially a guy that unstable, to testify. And the way Matt handled it was an abomination of justice. What you wanted to happen with something like that is the exact conversation Daredevil and the Punisher had in the cemetery after they escape the Russians. And that's a very emotional, sympathetic telling of the story with Frank talking about his family, what his daughter meant, how they died. You wanted that kind of remorse and human connection because you want the jurors sobbing. Because the picture that's been painted of Frank Castle is he's the Punisher and he just butchers people. And so they've been presented this animal who's a killing machine. And if you can humanize him and make everybody cry, you are now opening the door to something else. Because the only way to truly save Frank Castle is to get the jury to nullify all the charges. And the concept of jury nullification is best described as the Chewbacca defense. Because you can't outright ask the jury, ignore the law. Just ignore it. And say he's innocent. That's how you get disbarred. Okay, you can't do that. But that's frequently what happens in some high-profile cases.
Because a jury can absolutely ignore the law.
Yeah.
In a criminal case in particular, they can ignore the law and vote to acquit even if the law says that the person is guilty.
A great example of this, and it's also a great example of how not to do a closing argument, is actually the O.J. trial. If you watch Johnny Cochran's closing argument, there is no discussion about burden of proof. There's no discussion about the charges. There's no discussion about the jury instructions. It's a complete non sequitur. And they could have done something like that if they could have gotten the jury to see Frank Castle as a human being. And if you check out her blog, I actually took the time to outline what that line of questioning would look like, because it's really detailed in getting him to talk about everything that happens and then ending with the impact of getting people to connect with him.
And you don't get to declare your own witness hostile and then turn around and make a speech to the jury and then look at the judge and say, I have no further questions.
Yeah.
Because you didn't actually ask any questions.
So Daredevil Season 1 had Steve DeKnight as the showrunner on that, and they did a better job with the trial that was in Season 1. So in the episode Rabbit in a Snowstorm is where they have the trial of John Healy. That's at least ballpark. So there are some problems with it, with the expedited part of the trial. New York, you can't have a murder trial as an expedited hearing. Like, it doesn't work that way. You can't do that. The other thing, if you're arguing self-defense, you actually need the defendant to testify about why they were afraid and why their subjective fear of the situation was reasonable. And they also flipped the burden of proof. Those minor details aside, that trial in Season 1 was ballpark, at least. They did a much better job in Season 1 in depicting how the practice of law actually works, where Season 2, it goes out the window.
It's painful.
Yeah, it's you don't have client, you don't discuss your clients in front of other clients, which Matt and Foggy do in their waiting room with bananas. It's like you don't do that. But let's talk about Luke Cage, because this might be the strongest show that they have.
Okay. So Luke Cage, Bulletproof. Does he have a duty to warn people who are attacking him, hey, if you punch me, you're going to break your fist?
No.
We had a little discussion about this. I'm kind of like, well, if you go under property law, a landowner has a duty to warn of non-obvious defects on their property or hazardous conditions on their property. Would this be considered a hazardous condition? But at the same time, if you come and punch me, or you're about to punch me, I don't have to warn you, hey, I've got a gun in my back pocket. This is very similar to that. So if you're going to commit a crime on somebody, generally they do not have a duty to warn you that they are invincible or that you are going to get hurt very badly if you attempt this.
Plus he's just fantastic. Let's just be honest. That they throw a punch, guy breaks his fist, and he said, don't hit me, and he did anyway.
He does it again. So at that point, you've been warned. It's on you if you keep hitting.
I remember the last guy's like, I'm out. So when you realize, oh, he's super strong and bulletproof, I'm out of here. So no, he shouldn't have to warn people, don't hit me. Which then brings us to how he got to be bulletproof, and you can't do prison experiments on people. Okay, everything that happens in Seagate are like massive constitutional violations. So when we see Luke at the beginning of The Defenders, Seagate should be getting shut down because of the civil rights trials that should be happening with, so there's prisoner fighting and you put the footage on YouTube? No. And, oh, he was beat up, so then we did this radical medical experiment on him without his consent. So that's stuff the Nazis did. And we actually wrote laws, and we have treaties saying you don't get to experiment on human beings without their consent. And in the cases where there are experiments done on prisoners, they actually have like multi-steps to protect their civil rights.
Ethics boards.
And so it's not like one dude going like, well, let's go for it.
Hey, he says, yes, let's go. No, I mean, there are multiple ethics boards, multiple levels of protection.
So it would be super fun to see the civil rights trial, because that private prison, whether it's state or federal, would go down in flames. And it would be an awesome trial. And that's where the show should have gone.
Definitely.
At least, I think so. Let's talk about Iron Fist.
So the Hand is selling synthetic heroin, and they've got over-the-top, sexy women out there selling synthetic heroin, claiming it's legal.
Because it's synthetic.
Yeah, no.
You're all going to jail still.
I don't care that it doesn't have the exact chemical makeup of actual heroin. It's still illegal. The law doesn't spell out, okay, heroin, which has this chemical makeup, is a Schedule I drug. So if you tweak this chemical, it's no longer illegal. No. Your Schedule I drugs are based on whether or not it has a high potential for abuse. Has no currently accepted medical treatment in the United States, never mind elsewhere, and that there's a lack of accepted safety for the use of the drug under medical supervision. That's what makes a Class 1 drug. So if in synthetic heroin that gives the same effects as regular heroin, it's illegal.
No,
they're all going to jail.
No, yeah, both federal and New York law says if it's a synthetic drug that has the same effects as the real drug, it's still illegal. So they would be prosecuted. So the fact that the bad guys are making up the law saying like, well, in our legal opinion, we can't be prosecuted, the DA and U.S. attorney would have a very different point of view, as would the judge. Because bringing that motion to dismiss for lack of causes because it's synthetic heroin would not work. They're going to jail.
Yes.
Iron Fist.
Yeah.
Let's talk about resurrecting Elektra. So we have laws in this country. Now, nothing specifically on resurrection, because that would change a whole bunch of things like life insurance and wills and trusts if people could come back from the dead. Like, it would make them...
Oh, the life plus 21 years would...
It gets super complicated.
That would be very complicated.
However, we have some really old laws that the Hand would know about since they're an ancient organization. Digging up a body is a crime in New York. Taking the body out of its grave and moving it someplace else to either give to another person or for an experiment or whatever you want to do with a dead body is the crime of body stealing. And it's a Class D felony. And if somebody gives you a dead body, that's a misdemeanor. So when the fact the Hand is a giant conspiracy, they could all be convicted for all three crimes that take place. Because Alexandra is definitely the thumb of the Hand, and everything's done at her direction, and when they get her body, while we don't have anything about resurrection, it's kind of like an autopsy. It's kind of like...
It's a medical experiment on a dead body.
It's not desecration of a corpse because she comes back to life. So that's out. There could be an interesting wrongful life case if Matt was like her, had power of attorney over her.
Or guardian ad litem.
Yeah. The fact she comes back to life and starts killing people left and right, that was not intended, and the original Elektra did not do that. So there could be some interesting causes of action against the Hand for that. just bad. Let's talk about when Jessica and Luke are brought into the station by Misty after Stick is killed by Elektra. Matt says he represents both. What's wrong with that?
You can't. You cannot represent multiple clients if there is a potential conflict, absent a conflict waiver. Now, in a criminal matter, I don't even think you can waive that conflict. So, for instance, if Josh and I here got arrested on our way out of here, and I got assigned a public defender, the San Francisco Public Defender's Office couldn't represent him, too, because that would be a conflict within the firm. So one attorney can't represent two criminal defendants if there is a potential conflict. And you certainly can't do it if you were a potential witness. There are very few areas where a lawyer could be a witness in the case, but not this one. He can't represent them, and he certainly can't represent them both. He's got to pick one.
Yeah. And if he started representing Jessica, he should stay with her. Plus, they were a really good team. Great chemistry. Now, we do have, this is some of the neat stuff about the defenders, because Jessica's the one who throws down the truth quite frequently. So when they talk about blowing up the building, her reaction was like, that's domestic terrorism and obstruction of justice. And do you know what? Gold star, because our alcoholic is right. It is. It totally is obstruction of justice. And because they stole the C4. That's bad. And you know what? Yes, it would be domestic terrorism. It meets the statute perfectly. So, gold star, they're really in the ballpark with a lot
of
their...
They got that one right.
Yeah, they frequently do. So with that, we have time for a few questions. Yes, sir. No, but we'll repeat it.
Somebody in Berkeley was selling what he said was LSD. People were buying it and getting high. Turned out that it was just drops of food coloring on a piece of paper. A powerful suggestion. They thought it was LSD, they got high. He was arrested, and I've always wondered what the charge was.
So the question is, Berkeley, so take that into consideration, and I do love Berkeley. And somebody was selling food coloring and saying it was LSD, and people were tripping on food coloring. So what could he be arrested for? Public nuisance? I mean, what else do you think could be? Because people were just tripping by the power of suggestion.
Really?
There you go. Practicing business without a license, yes, that does sound good. It's not, because it's illegal to sell.
Fraud,
but yeah, that's funky and makes sense. It would be from Berkeley.
Yes.
I saw another hand, yes.
You had mentioned that the hand could be charged with body stealing, but if Elektra is alive, could you argue a defense that what you did is somehow legally invalid?
Yes, that would be probably the first argument of she came back. It wasn't body stealing anymore, but there was the act of body stealing.
It doesn't negate the fact that you dug her up, you were holding a dead body, you transported a dead body. The fact that she came alive later poses some problems, but
I've actually done lots of research with dead bodies, which I didn't expect to be a practice area, but thanks to shows like there were lots of shows. There was one season from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. to Sleepy Hollow where there was just all these people digging up dead bodies, and I started researching dead bodies, and it's problematic when they come back to life. But you could still argue that the underlying act took place and that the unlawful medical experiment, because I doubt any of these guys were licensed doctors, you could still make those arguments, but the law's not designed for resurrection.
Well, and the ends don't just necessarily justify the means. You can still be prosecuted for the means even if the end is a good one.
Yes, ma'am.
I might have missed it at the start, but in Jessica Jones, when she captures Kilgrave and attempts to force him to confess, would that confession, if she films it, hold up in court of law?
Absolutely not. So we actually have a... This is a hybrid presentation from a couple with a lot of defenders material. We have another that's just on Jessica Jones and Daredevil, and that we actually got into that in that one. It is absolutely invalid because it's duress. They're torturing him. They're electrocuting him, trying to get him to talk, and then she goes in and slaps him around. That's not admissible, and Hogarth could end up getting just barred for that. Yes, and the fact that Hogarth gets her soon-to-be ex-wife killed is also a no-no.
Maybe she didn't know better because she was practicing so many areas of law.
Yeah, Hogarth is a very tough character for me because they keep lumping stuff on top of her. That's not okay. You don't have lawyers sleeping with secretaries. You don't have the things that she was doing. You don't have ex-wives wanting 90% of your income, and you're not hiring PIs to go rough up your ex-wife. I'm like, there's all these things that Jerry Hogarth does that should have ended her legal career. So she's a bad lawyer. Oh, you're done? Okay. Sir in the red? Oh, and the defenders, yeah, that's a convenient comic book ending because they totally could have gone after them. Part of it, I don't know if they just didn't want to deal with it, but the cover-up doesn't make sense because when you look at the initial reasons for the cover-up with City Hall that's now playing USGS and talking about an earthquake happening is because the hand has influence over somebody in City Hall. So from an administration of justice, there doesn't make sense for that to be happening other than if they just don't want to deal with a super-powered trial taking place. And that could be it, that they just don't want more attention brought upon vigilantes because they do have great lines with, vigilantes don't have jurisdiction. The police are right to be ticked off.
Yeah.
And we understand why the heroes don't bring in the police because they don't know who to trust and they don't want people to die. So, like, we get their motivation, but the police are right. And Misty does get her bionic arm. So, yes, sir.
So, when Batman captures the bad guys and the criminals and he ties them up and sets them on the street corner, and the police show up, is there anything that they can do? Like, oh, let me help you out? Or...
So we're going to touch a little bit on that in the Jack Kirby presentation tomorrow at 8:30. So stay tuned. But yeah, the law is not designed for that sort of thing to be happening because
I mean, unless he's coming to testify as a witness. I mean, at this point, you've got no witness to a crime. You've got no evidence. You've just got a guy on a street corner tied up. You're going to have a hard time proving that case.
Which is why Scott Snyder's run on Batman with Bat Jim, where we have Commissioner Gordon as Batman, was so great because he would assist in the capture and then have other police officers finish the arrest. And so they would be the testifying officers, and Scott Snyder deserves a gold star for thinking that through. So, well done. I lost track of the hands. I think you, then you, then you. Yes, sir.
When Luke gets out of jail and then Misty asks him to start looking into crimes in the neighborhood for her, is that legal since he's not a cop and doesn't have any kind of jurisdiction? She knows that he's going to start beating people up.
So the question is, when Misty asks Luke after he's back from Seagate to go check in on the kid who was... the brother of the sister was killed at the end of Luke Cage. I think that's okay as long as he wasn't crossing into law enforcement because he was being asked to go mentor a kid. And I think that's perfectly acceptable for her to ask him to go be a big brother. you know, to go help out the community. I think
and
that's
and
fair.
Even to do a little investigation into what's going on would be acceptable. However, is he violating any parole issues? Would be a concern.
So at San Diego Comic-Con, we did a mock trial on how to prove the actual innocence of Luke Cage. And we have the brief written on the blog because we were at least in the ballpark. There's exculpatory evidence in the folder that Bobby Fish turns over to Hogarth, and that we were right about that. And we guessed it probably would have been heroin, which was came from the comic book history. So I think he could have been proven to be totally innocent and not have any parole issues. There was a hand over here. I think the gentleman gray. Yeah.
Question about, not to dwell on the Iron Fist, I know it's not your favorite, but hearing the idea of people coming back from the dead, when Meacham comes back from the dead, shouldn't the board have been able to say, absolutely not, and just at least I'm going to take them forward immediately? I mean, they all kind of evaporated.
Yeah, it fell apart. And I do love Iron Fist the character, and I loved seeing Luke and Danny in The Defenders. Their chemistry is great, and it's going to be a beautiful bromance, and I embrace it. But Iron Fist with somebody being dead for 15 years and then coming back, legally, that is so complicated. In my dead research I did, the only things that I found were comparable were people who did insurance fraud, or disappeared and the surviving spouse collected insurance and the guy turns out to be alive. In those cases, they didn't have to give back the money. Now, if somebody came back trying to take control of a corporation, I think the board would say, no, stay dead. I think the gentleman in the Batman shirt. Yes. When you are forcing people against their wills to have sex with you, that's rape.
In the eyes of the court, they couldn't prove it without coercing a confession on
the kill rape. We have a great blog post that explains how to prove it medically because he admits the virus. And being able to show how that virus would infect brain cells would be the way to medically prove how somebody was influenced by Kilgrave.
I mean, it'd be very, very similar to slipping somebody a roofie, in that it lowers their inhibition, makes them not realize what they're doing, and that would, in fact, be a crime.
Okay. And happy to chat. We want to make room for the next panelist. Yes, sir.
So the clergy privilege, it applies if you are seeking spiritual guidance from a member of a religion. So, if I go seek spiritual guidance from Josh,
I'm thoughtful, but I'm not a clergy member.
Right. He may be an attorney. I may have attorney-client privilege with him, but we certainly don't have the clergy privilege. It needs to be from somebody who is it's an established religion.
Yeah. Not the Church of Josh.
Right.
Where do we find the blog?
So thelegalgeeks.com, conveniently on the screen. And we will return. So tomorrow, 8:30 p.m., we'll be talking about Jack Kirby and civil rights and digging into the Kirby Centennial and how we have wonderful civil rights issues from the stories he worked on. Sunday morning at 11.
Okay.
Star Wars Law with Circuit Judge John Owens from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So
that'll be a fun one.
Yes. So see you tomorrow, and thank you all for attending.
Thank you.